from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's Forum program, a trip through history.
San Francisco mushroomed from a quiet trading post into a boom town.
From the gold rush.
There was mud in the streets, but there was gold to spend.
To World War II, when the Bay Area bustled with wartime industry.
And the Great East Bay, with its unparalleled harbor and factory site, became a keystone in Uncle Sam's arsenal of democracy.
To the current tech boom. Throughout the Bay Area's history, workers and entrepreneurs have flocked here to make their fortunes and spend their money. We'll examine how past economic booms and busts have shaped the Bay Area. It's the launch of KQED's new Boomtown series, exploring the effects of the Bay Area's surging economy. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Today, we launch KQED's new Boomtown series, exploring the changing Bay Area, the surging economy, the cost of living, gentrification, and displacement. And to launch this series, we're going to talk with three historians about the booms and busts in Bay Area history. But first, we want to check in with KQED Executive Editor of News, Holly Kernan, about the Boomtown series. Morning, Holly.
Good morning, Michael.
Memory serves me here. We did a Boomtown series years ago. We were talking about the computer superhighway and dot-coms and so forth.
Yeah, well, this is a boom and bust economy that we live in, going back to before the gold rush even. It almost feels like this boom is different. It'll be interesting to hear from our historians about sort of the similarities and differences. The San Francisco Chronicle just said that the Bay Area has added an estimated 400,000 jobs in the past 4 years. San Francisco's population has grown by 32,000 since 2010, but has put fewer than 9,000 new housing units into the city. So there's just so much happening. So we wanted to put a sustained microscope and microphone on what's happening, all of these radical changes, and ask, you know, how is it changing our actual landscape, our economies, our communities, in terms of political and cultural impacts, what's happening? So we'll be reporting on all of that. And one thing that we're doing a little bit differently, Michael, is we're asking our audiences to really dictate, to help produce this series by telling us what they want us to be reporting on, what they want to see. Today on KQED.org, you'll see a series by the first in a series by Dan Brecky looking at the history of boom and bust here. So
listeners can get involved, and they can get involved just by going to KQED.org.
Yep, or they can call if they have questions, 415-553-2365. That's 415-553-2365, or go to KQED.org/Boomtown, and you can ask your questions there. Some of the things that listeners have asked us to look at is how is the current tech-driven boom driving the Bay Area philanthropy and giving? Has that changed? Are there political organizations working to make San Francisco more affordable? Who are they and what kind of help do they need? I own an apartment building with two-bedroom apartments renting for $1,925 per month when the booming market is asking for $2,200 per month. So how can local families afford such rent increases during this boom cycle? Lots and lots of questions.
And we hope lots of answers.
Yeah, we promise lots of answers or some answers.
Well, we're looking forward to this ongoing series, and we're going to kick it off, as I said here, by talking to some eminent historians. Thank you, Holly.
Thanks,
and good
Michael.
Luck and congratulations on the series.
I ain't got no home nor nothing, I suppose. Misfortune seems to follow me wherever I goes. I come to California with a heart both stout and bold, and have been up to the diggings there to get some lumps of gold. But I'm a used up man.
All right, in this hour, we want to look back, and really forward as well. The long tradition of economic booms and busts, you heard about it most recently from Governor Jerry Brown, they've shaped certainly Bay Area history, landscape, culture, and industry, and we want to discuss what lessons can be learned from the history as we grapple with the current economic and technological boom that is once again transforming our area. Let me tell you who is joining us for the hour here in studio. Richard White is professor of American history at Stanford University. He was with us last on Forum talking about his excellent book, Railroaded, the Transcontinentals and the Making of Modern America. Good to have you back. Welcome.
Good to be back.
Christopher O'Sullivan, also with us this hour, teaches California history, University of San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning to you. And we'll say good morning to Leslie Berlin, who's also here with us this morning, project historian for the Silicon Valley Archives at Stanford University and author of The Man Behind the Microchip, Robert Noyce and the Invention of Silicon Valley. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to all of you. And thank you all again for joining us. And Richard White, I'm going to begin with you because I think you said that in the 1850s, around the time of the gold rush, this was the most bizarre place in the North American continent. But also, I was reading J.S. Halliday, who said this is maybe the gold rush, just to start with that, the most important event, not only in California history, but American history next to the Civil War. A grand statement.
A very grand statement. And I'd give him California. I don't think I'd give him American history. But in California, it makes California. I mean, it sets California off on a trajectory, which we're still going down the road. It started this on today. It makes California the capital of the West. It's San Francisco becomes a city very different from any other metropolis, any place in North America, and one of the only cities in west of the Mississippi that can compete with Boston, Washington, Philadelphia, New York.
Well, let's talk just for a moment about the distinct culture that grew up historically around that first boom, that is the gold rush. I mean, it was overly defined by wealth to a great degree, and it was also a place that had its own laws. I mean, it was pretty rough, as we learned from many of the writers of that time. There were lynchings. It wasn't the sort of culture that many of those who emigrated here from the Northeast particularly were used to.
No, it wasn't. It was an un-American place in a real sense. And it's un-American by that, I mean, in a society which largely organized itself around home, around family. This is a place without homes. It's a place without families.
And it was mostly men. What, 90%
men? 90% men. And it's not only men. And they're men from all over the world. I mean, a place where the United States had maybe 10% of the population were immigrants. It was near 40-50% in San Francisco. They had very little to hold them together except the search for wealth. And many California laws where it was a sort of libertarian paradise, as if nothing existed in human life except getting rich. And when you got rich, you didn't intend to stay here. You intended to go back. As I said at the time, it's, you know, California is a good place to make money, but New England's the place you want to spend it.
There are some analogies that creep into even present thought. Again, Richard White is professor of American history, Stanford, author of Railroaded, The Transcontinentals, and The Making of Modern America. Christopher O'Sullivan teaches California history at University of San Francisco. And by the way, on Thursday, he'll be launching the American Association of University Women's Forum Lecture Series on California History at the Raven Performing Arts Theater in Healdsburg. And let's talk a bit, Christopher O'Sullivan, about just booms in general. They usually mean new beginnings, as Kevin Starr said, but they're also often redolent of all kinds of hope, maybe illusion and pipe dreaming as well, but that's certainly what they're associated with and have been with every boom. But I want to get a sense from you of how we calibrate what the booms are. I mean, there was one with the gold rush. Then there was one again. There was kind of a silver boom and a small boom after that. The two world wars.
Yes. Well, consider some of the numbers to begin with. I mean, we have the gold rush, which almost stands alone in San Francisco, which was then the Mexican-Californian pueblo of Yerba Buena. The population was about 469 people at the time that gold was discovered. And they had just undergone a population boom because the population had been doubled to 469 by a huge boatload of Mormons who had just arrived in Yerba Buena just before that. Within a year, by 1849, the population of San Francisco was 25,000. So this was just an enormous explosion of growth, the likes of which I'm not sure if any other city, when we think of boomtown, San Francisco always comes to mind, even around the world. But other booms that have occurred in textiles with the Midlands and Britain and things like this, you never had this kind of overnight explosion.
And let me just jump ahead for a few, because after the railroad, that even, I'm thinking about the railroad in conjunction with Richard White's book, leaped even more.
Well, yes, but Richard can speak better to that than I, because he's written a very fine book about that. But he'll also point out that the anticipated boom that the transcontinental was supposed to bring actually brought depression in the 1870s. But we had a silver boom at the end of the 1850s, which followed almost exactly 10 years on the gold rush. And there have been a series of booms in San Francisco involving real estate speculation. Consider this, that during the gold rush and throughout the 1850s, people think the property situation and the real estate situation in the city is acute right now, and indeed it is. But then people were buying water lots. And what that means is they were buying geographical areas in the bay with the anticipation that the bay would ultimately be filled into the point where they'd be able to build on that area.
A lot of tents, too.
That's right.
But let's jump ahead again, because we did see a boom after World War II, and that mm-hmm. was largely a boom. And in fact, some argue that it went on until the 1990 recession because of government defense research
That's
and
right.
all of that money.
The World War II boom sort of seamlessly went into the Cold War because there was a lot of spending pouring into California. Southern California benefited largely from aerospace. The San Francisco Bay Area from all the bases that were here. We forget that the Bay Area historically is really a military area, and a lot of those bases closed after 1990. Consider this in terms of numbers. From 1950 to up at 1950 was about the peak population up till that time. About 825,000 people lived in San Francisco. There was a significant population decline from 1950 to about 1980. Where the population dropped to about 675,000. It's now bounced back up to about 825,000. So we're feeling the strain, the same kind of strain that began during the Second World War, where people were being housed in places that today would be considered lean-tos and not quality housing for anyone to live in.
Well, the one thing that binds all of these booms together is the recurrent sense of change and transformation, yes?
Yes, absolutely.
And leading right up to the present, which brings me to Leslie Berlin. But before I do that, I want to talk about just also the fact that World War II and that post-World War, Cold War boom, actually, as you described it, I think, correctly, really brought with it the building up of the two major universities. And now, by contrast, it's just kind of interesting to think of what the GI Bill did and all of that, contrasting now to all the debt that people are suffering
Absolutely.
With this boom, you know, college debt particularly.
Absolutely, Michael. Consider, I think one thing that really separates this boom from some of the previous ones is people are justifiably feeling the income inequality of this current boom. That wasn't really a major factor with some of the previous booms, particularly with the Second World War and with the Cold War boom, because a lot of the jobs that were being created by all that government largesse coming to the Bay Area were working class jobs, were jobs in shipbuilding and ancillary industries and things like that. So that's, I think, a real distinctive difference about the current boom from some of the previous ones is income inequality.
But let me just go back for a moment, Richard White, to you, because we saw, going back to the gold rush for a moment, extraordinary consumer market and overpricing, I mean, as a result of all the money that people had, particularly those who laid stakes to mines that they could mine and find gold at. I mean, there again are some parallels to the present. We've got high prices now, but we have consumer goods being produced not to such a great extent. I mean, Apple, yes, but a lot of ads being produced as a result of some of the new technology.
There's certainly high pricing, but what you had, and I think this is something that's missing from the current boom, is that there was a feeling that getting gold is a matter of luck, and it's open to anybody. And if you can get out here and you don't have a great deal of skill, you can strike it rich. And they realize that, in fact, there's not a lot of merit to striking it rich. It's, nobody thinks of this as a meritocracy. If some people get rich, other people don't. And the wages just from at least in 49 and 50 from digging gold were enough that people could afford the prices. After that, they begin to move back. There's a great deal of disillusionment. But I think you have this sense of privilege, this talk about meritocracy, this sense of that wealth is something people deserve as a result of their hard work. I don't think that's gold rush language. I mean, they talk more the language of luck, of chance, of fortune. They liken it to gambling.
It was hard work, though.
Mining was very hard work. It was very hard work, but you didn't intend to keep doing it for very long.
And if you failed, in many instances, you didn't want to come home with failure trailing behind you.
You didn't, but that means you headed off someplace else. You didn't stick around here, too. So, I mean, one of the things we forget about these booms is that there's an incredible churning of population. As you see the numbers, but those 10,000 people, each year it's a different 10,000. They're in, they're out, they're gone. And that's one of the characteristics of boom towns then, and I think now, too.
Well, let's talk about now with Leslie Berlin, who again is project historian for the Silicon Valley Archives at Stanford University and author of The Man Behind the Microchip, Robert Noyce, and The Invention of Silicon Valley. The invention of Silicon Valley, contrary to many people's perception, wasn't necessarily so much in garages, as I think you point out in an article of yours I read. It was largely financial and technological and cultural.
And I would be quick to add, very heavily dependent on the Department of Defense and military spending, particularly early on. As a matter of fact, I think it's safe to sort of point the birth of Silicon Valley to World War II, when you have, two major influences. One is the actual location of Silicon Valley, which is for all the shipbuilding and such that was happening up in the city, people who were starting to think about starting companies thought, we want to go somewhere where there's not such a strong union presence. And that was actually a significant factor in addition to the incredibly cheap cost of land in what is now Silicon Valley during the World War II era.
Ah, to remember.
Yes, yes. So But in addition, the sorts of military spending that we're talking about was absolutely vital. If you look at the early Silicon Valley companies, if you take, for example, just Hewlett-Packard and look at their profits, it's a nice little up and to the right line until World War II, when you have this absolute hockey stick. And the 100%, if you jump forward about 15 years, 100% of the microchips that were built and invented here in Silicon Valley were bought by the Department of Defense for use in Cold War technology. So from the very beginning, this is economy in Silicon Valley was very dependent on the military. In fact, I would go so far as to say that the military served as the first venture capitalist in Silicon Valley.
Well, I noticed also that you point out that Shockley and particularly the transistor were sort of major in terms of helping to shape what became Silicon Valley.
Yeah. I'm always a little afraid of sounding too deterministic, but I think that the reality of the technology that was planted here, namely the transistor, which arrived in 1956 in the form of William Shockley, who would go on to win the Nobel Prize for his invention of the transistor, you could not have picked a more wonderful technology to lay in the very fertile ground, and I mean that both literally and metaphorically, that was Silicon Valley, because you can think of the transistor as this little bitty, as the grain of sand inside of a pearl that still continues to grow. So
From there to microchips, on and on we go,
right.
Morphing. Yeah.
Exactly, until you get to personal computers and then all the cloud technology. Everything that we think of as high tech today can, if you peel it away far enough, go back to that transistor. And a lot of the business and cultural sorts of how-to lessons that people learned in figuring out how to build and market the transistor, and especially the microchip, the integrated circuit, and going forward from that, have come into play in future generations of the technology, of the economy.
And yet, when we look at the two most recent booms in Silicon Valley, I was kidding with Holly before about the computer superhighway, almost seems nostalgic to think about that, but there really are fewer beneficiaries now. I mean, the last one, people joke about, you know, petfood.com and all the rest of those kinds of things, but now there's much more money going up to the top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this gets back to what we were talking about earlier about who gets the jobs. Well into the 80s, you had actual manufacturing jobs in Silicon Valley that were very high-paying jobs, not unionized, but high-paying because people there was so much competition that people could market themselves into good jobs just about anywhere. Now there's very little manufacturing in Silicon Valley, and what that means is that the primary beneficiaries are the highly educated, almost all in the science, technology, engineering, math fields.
Could we just do a little comparison about the two again, what's often called Silicon Valley 2 as opposed to Silicon Valley 1 or dot-com 1 versus whatever followed it? There's much more upfront costs that really took place. I mean, now not so much is needed in the second boom. And now it's more actually in some instances young people, you know, thinking up their apps and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And another big difference that I'll be interested to see how this plays out is, of course, part of the problem with the first dot-com boom was that these companies were they were in the public markets and growing like crazy. This meant a lot more of the general public who invests in these sorts of things was exposed. Right now, a lot of these companies are still private companies. When you look at who is actually building these things and starting these companies, right now people are able to become quite wealthy on small things like apps that you're describing. And whereas in the past, these dot-com type companies, these were large. There were lots of people involved from very early on, whereas now it's much smaller groups of people getting going.
Why do you think it stayed in Silicon Valley? I mean, when one became two, it was still Silicon Valley. It wasn't Detroit. It wasn't Cleveland. It wasn't Dallas or any place else.
This, to me, is the most interesting question about Silicon Valley that I'm never asked, which is why is it that it has persisted from the 1950s forward? Because this place has been able to bring in technology after technology after technology. I think that what happened was that you essentially had a self-perpetuating cycle kick off in as early as I would say the 60s and 70s. We developed an entire infrastructure around supporting entrepreneurs. And that has continued to exist to this day in terms of venture capital investment, angel investment. There's a very, very strong sense here among established and successful entrepreneurial types that they have a responsibility to go back and bring up the next generation of entrepreneurs. I think that has had a lot to do with it. And I also think that this sort of path dependency is, I think, really undervalued when people think about different regions. I think that everyone imagines the internet making it possible for us to transcend geography. You don't have to live where you work and this sort of thing. But I think that the sort of being in a place where you're constantly crossing other people who are doing what you're doing and interested in what you're in, not just at work, but at a little league game or when you're walking the dog or you're at church or you're at the grocery store or you're wherever you may be, these sorts of interactions lead to a general sense of, I can only describe it as cultural excitement that hasn't really been replicable anywhere else, including online.
And let's not minimize just how nice it is to live in the Bay Area. I mean, there are many venture capitalists who would agree very quickly with that, as well as others who make up Silicon Valley. I'm going to do this. We're talking about booms, and you can't certainly talk about booms without talking about busts, but having a historical look as we kick off this new Boomtown series of ours here at KQED and discussing the economic booms and busts in Bay Area history, particularly as we launch the new series Boomtown, but exploring today really the history behind booms. And we'd like to hear from you. If you have questions or comments, you can join us now, and let me tell you how you can do that. Our toll-free number is available to you, and we welcome your phone calls. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. Again, you can join us right now by dialing in at 866-733-6786 or emailing us, our email address, forum@kqed.org. Or you can post any questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Talking with Leslie Berlin, who is project historian for the Silicon Valley Archives at Stanford, and Christopher O'Sullivan, who is a California history teacher at the University of San Francisco, and Richard White, professor of American history at Stanford, author of Railroaded, The Transcontinentals and the Making of Modern America. We'll hear from you when we return. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, if you look at California history, you find booms and busts. In fact, you find that not only in California history, but probably throughout American history. But we're discussing the economic booms and busts in Bay Area history specifically. It's the launch of KQED's new series, Boomtown, exploring the effects of the Bay Area's surging economy in a broader sense. But today, looking at things historically, and we spoke earlier with our executive editor of news, Holly Kernan, who has helped launch this series and spearheaded it. And with us for the hour, Richard White, professor of American history at Stanford, and and author of Railroaded, The Transcontinentals and the Making of Modern America, and Christopher O'Sullivan, who is a California history teacher at the University of San Francisco, and on Thursday he'll be launching the American Association of University Women's Forum Lecture Series on California History at the Raven Performing Arts Theater in Healdsburg. And Leslie Berlin is here with us as well, project historian for the Silicon Valley Archives at Stanford and author of The Man Behind the Microchip, Robert Noyce, and the Invention of Silicon Valley. And we certainly would like to hear from you if you have thoughts about booms and busts, if you want to find out more historically, and we'll talk a bit more about what brings them at least to some degree of commonality and what perhaps is particularly divergent from the different booms as we've defined them here in this hour. We would like to hear from you. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You can also communicate with us and join the conversation by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum, and of course you can also go to our Facebook page. But let's talk about immigration, because Richard White played a central role really in all these booms.
Yeah, it's starting with the gold rush. I mean, the gold rush is, as I said, California has 40% to 50% immigrants in by 1860, and I think, I mean, Chris can correct me here, but I think up until the 20th century, California is by far the heaviest immigrant state, large state in the country. We always retained that, and San Francisco always retained it. It's Chinese, it's German, it's Irish. World War II, it's less immigrants from abroad, of course, but it's immigrants from all over the country are coming in, particularly
you mentioned Isabel Wilkerson's book about the migration from the Black South.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the Black South and the White South, too. I mean, it's Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas. They move in. And then, of course, the current boom is a boom which once were more California's multi-ethnic, multinational. So in these ways, all the booms do string together. They've all been heavily influenced by immigrants from outside.
There's new brain power that comes with immigrants, of course, but Christopher O'Sullivan, there's also the darker side of that. I mean, there were laws that were put in place against Mexicans during the gold rush. There were certainly laws against the Chinese that came later, although they were able to stay, and there was all that was done to the Indians.
Yeah. The Chinese faced a miners' tax in the 1850s, which was not applicable to other groups. There was terrible rampant racism throughout San Francisco in the 1850s. Roving gangs. Richard was talking about the lawlessness in this sort of a libertarian dream of a city of San Francisco where there were no laws. There were vigilance committees taking over and trying to establish some semblance of laws, but often carrying out horrible miscarriages of justice. And we've seen that. You know, Richard talked about immigrants coming into California, even within the country, we see a big surge of racism during the Second World War because suddenly California has a very, very small population of African Americans before the war. President Roosevelt signs an executive order in the summer of 1941, 6 months before Pearl Harbor, saying that there cannot be racial discrimination in wartime industries. And there's an enormous migration of both white and black people from all over the country, but particularly from the South and Texas and the Southwest to these industries in California, these wartime industries, shipping, aerospace, things like this. And the population, the African-American population of California surges to about 13%. Interesting, if you look at San Francisco, that was roughly the African-American population at this peak after the war, and it's now down to about 6%. So something very curious has happened to the African-American population in San Francisco, having dropped by more than half since its peak level.
And in Silicon Valley, of course, we had a lot of Asians who have come in and many people from particularly South Asia, India and so forth who continue to work there. Leslie Berlin. And there's also been the charge that this culture, we're talking about really cultures that grow up with the boom and become inseparable from the boom, has been, so it's argued, misogynistic. There have been glass ceilings where women are concerned. It's kind of a good old boys fraternity club and so forth. How much do you feel that really plays into outcome of the culture itself?
Yeah, this is something that I haven't studied myself, but the reports of discrimination against women have been very compelling and very upsetting. I think a lot of this is a sort of unconscious bias that's happening, and some of it is just outright misogyny. I can speak to that just from the perspective of someone who's read the same materials, listened to you and listened to other people talking about it. And in terms of the role of immigrants, this is the one thing that if I wish that people could take away about Silicon Valley. I mean, in Santa Clara County, 65% of the people with bachelor's degrees in Silicon Valley were born in another country. I mean, this is amazing. Two-thirds of the people who have completed college who live in Santa Clara County, which for a long time was sort of considered Silicon Valley. That definition has expanded, which we can talk about. Two-thirds of them are from born outside the country. Half of the companies started between 1995 and 2005, half of them have at least one founder who was born outside of the United States. And I have to believe that number is higher now. I think that this constant sort of refresh, this sort of intellectual refresh that comes with new waves of immigrants just can't be underestimated. And it's the reason that we see so much lobbying from tech companies about extending H-1B visas and keeping the doors open because the economy with all of its very real problems will only remain as vibrant as it is if this continues to be a highly desirable place to live. And I think this is part of the reason why we've seen people who are up in arms on all sides of the wage gap sorts of questions, because everyone wants this to be a place where people want to come and want to stay.
How about people of color, though, particularly at the top of Silicon Valley in the upper hierarchy? It's still a tough place to find oneself if one has a different color skin, is it not?
Well, I think that a lot of these companies actually do have founders who are from Asia, and I don't think that it's a particularly uncomfortable place in that sense. There are a lot of organizations that exist, things like TAI, the Indus Entrepreneurs. A lot of the universities actually from, say, South Korea, they have alumni organizations here that are incredibly strong, vibrant types of organizations that provide a lot of support. So I think that there is recognition that it is a very different kind of place. At the same time, I do think that a high-tech company is not a terrible place to be if you are someone who has the education behind you. Then your skin color, I think, is less important. Now, the question of who gets the education, that's another question.
That's another question indeed. And before we go to your calls and emails, I wanted to go back to Christopher O'Sullivan and just ask you, if I may, about gentrification. These booms push people out. Yes. Certainly what we see now in Silicon Valley, and there's natural fallout with the boom. Is there anything different about this boom in that regard that you see?
Well, very much so. I mean, if you look back, if we talk again about the Second World War and the Cold War, for example, a lot of the job creation that occurred as a result of that federal spending here was, well, I guess, what we'd call blue-collar work, and a lot of it was unionized. San Francisco was always a strong industrial union city, a very strong presence of the American Federation of Labor, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, and the current job growth is not really in that area. So we're finding that it's much more white-collar. As you mentioned, it requires a certain skill level, a certain skill set, higher education. So we have really, in a sense, abandoned a large swath of the population of the Bay Area who not only benefited from that job creation during the war and the Cold War, but keep in mind a big, big difference is that we had visionary governors at that time, Earl Warren, Goodwin Knight, Pat Brown, who thought about sustaining the boom. And how do you sustain the boom if you're anticipating the possibility of a bust? Investment in education. This is at least one way that you can try to mitigate some of the valleys, some of the troughs of a disastrous bust.
And now we have Pat Brown's son talking about a rainy day fund, at least as a way to insure against the bust or try to insure against the bust. I'm wondering, Richard White, since we had Christopher O'Sullivan just mentioned this being a labor city. Looking at a tweet from a listener named Doria, who says, please ask about how San Francisco became a beacon of liberalism. Was it due to the high proportion of immigrants in the gold rush?
No.
I didn't think so.
No, California becomes a liberal city largely doing the New Deal in the same way that the rest of the United States does. I mean, before that, it's as much going to be a progressive Republican city or a Democratic machine city. So it is certainly has a strong anti-monopolist strain in the late 19th century. It hates the railroad. Pretty much hatred of the Southern Pacific defines an awful lot of California politics. But in our definition of liberalism, which is different from 19th century liberalism, that I think starts with Roosevelt and the New Deal. And our history is not that different from many other places.
And here's a listener who sort of backs up what I said, but from a different perspective, says one of the reasons for the boom is that there's great natural beauty in outdoor activities. This active lifestyle appeals to creative risk takers. You can ski in the morning and surf in the evening. Another listener says, while you're talking about the government's role in Silicon Valley, don't forget to mention DARPANET. Okay, we have. In fact, we mentioned it yesterday as well, and now we'll get your calls. And Lauren, you're first up here. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, thanks for having me on. This is exciting. I wanted to call in as a native San Franciscan and sort of comment on the lack of involvement of real San Franciscans that were born and raised here in the tech boom. Neither I or my peers from school are, involved in tech, and I wanted to reflect on, the backlash that happens against tech in a way, because we feel like we're so not involved. Meanwhile, so many, immigrants from other countries are, coming here and getting jobs and we're sort of not prepared and not able to benefit from the tech boom. And kind of get your thoughts on why that is and why, I feel like we're really not involved.
Yeah. And maybe get some historical background of this about the effect of on native populations of these booms. Some thoughts from any of you?
Well, I mean, each boom
looking
tends
toward Christopher, looking toward Richard. Richard, go ahead.
So, I mean, each boom tends to bring in new people, but also displaces people. Pretty much the end of Mexican California is going to be the gold rush, at least in the northern part of California, not so much Southern California. World War II, the great complaint was, of course, all these migrants coming in. There was a great backlash against them, mostly against, as Christopher said, against African-American migrants, but against migrants in general. The difference is, I think, during World War II and the boom that follows in the Cold War is people who move out of the city are choosing to move out of the city to more desirable locations. This is when people wanted to move to the suburbs. This is the idea we're going to have these garden cities, that the inner city is going to decline. And what we're having is, I think, a reverse kind of migration now, is that certainly people are wanting to move back into the city, and that's very different. And so what you do have, the kind of displacement native San Franciscans feel, is the kind of displacement native San Franciscans have felt for about 150 years, is each one of these rushes, each one of these brooms brings in new populations and doesn't totally upset the old hierarchy. I think the very elite of San Francisco has hardly suffered from this because real estate values rise. But for ordinary San Franciscans, there can be a sense that they're losing hold of their own city. And this is something that's recurred over and over and over again.
My mother's platitude, one of her favorites. The more things change, the more they stay the same. I mean, it comes to mind here. And we'll bring another caller who will come to mind and join us. And that's Nancy. Good morning.
Good morning. So I was responding to the comment that your guest from the archive made earlier. And you were asking the question of why Silicon Valley and why not Detroit or Cleveland or Dallas, right? And my answer to that is, I think that, as a Cal graduate, I hate to admit this, but I think Stanford has a very positive policy toward launching companies, and the way in which they license the intellectual property has made it very welcoming for people who have that entrepreneurial spirit. Other institutions do not give as much of the IP back to the individuals and claim a lot more of it earlier. And so they don't create that environment for business to flourish.
I think when you say very positive, you're probably understating it, Nancy. Can I go to you on this, Leslie Berlin?
Yeah.
Stanford plays a central role.
Stanford does play a central role. Not in every single important technology. You could argue that Stanford played a little catch up when it came to the chip industry, which is interesting since that was so important. But yes, from the 50s on, when Stanford decides, we want, basically Stanford had a lot of land and a lot of property taxes to pay and wanted to start making that land work for them, and made a provost named Frederick Terman made a decision to go ahead and focus on what was called smokeless industry, which now we would call high-tech industry, and actively encouraged the building of an industrial park near Stanford, which is to this day where Hewlett-Packard's headquarters are, set up a closed-circuit television station so that engineers at these companies could get degrees from Stanford. There had been a big concern that Stanford graduates were all having to leave and go east in order to get jobs. And again, World War II comes into play. Frederick Terman came back after the war and said, we need to build up our own industry here. And I'm so glad you pointed to the licensing of technologies out of Stanford. The book that I'm working on now, which is about Silicon Valley in the 70s, this is one of the stories I'm telling. And Stanford actually had one person, Niels Reimers, who decided that Stanford needed to change how they started licensing these ideas that were coming out of the university. And with that push, and again, you could ask, what is it about Stanford that made it okay for one guy with an idea, a very low-level guy, to make this big change? But with that one push, Stanford evolved into a very liberal license, not just licensing policy, but also rules about how professors can consult to companies. And yeah, so it's been a very symbiotic relationship. Stanford right now is working hard to make sure that people don't think it's only a tech school. There's a lot of focus now on bringing in the arts, the liberal arts, this sort of thing. But you're right, that has been a very important part of the equation.
But I still understand there's talk to freshman classes about, in case you come up with something entrepreneurial or if you have an idea, IPO, whatever, you know, this place will encourage and help as much as we can. Now, back, Christopher O'Sullivan, Joe, just to what we had alluded to before, which is the role that universities, major universities, play in these booms, particularly here with not only Stanford but UC Berkeley.
Yeah, I think that was a big mitigating factor in alleviating the possibility of backlash during earlier booms in a way that isn't there today. Because if you look at it from the perspective of a young person, you know, even if you weren't directly benefiting from the earlier industrial and shipbuilding booms, you were living in a state that in some ways was very wisely taking advantage of that boom and investing in public infrastructure. And the most important part of that was public ed. I mean, California, for a brief golden period from about the Warren administration up until a few decades ago, was one of the few places in the world where you could go to school from K through PhD for free. And that was remarkable. And governors like Warren and Knight and Brown didn't do that because they thought it was necessary. Well, they maybe did it because they thought it was the right thing to do or the moral thing to do. But more important, it was economically important to do this. You were investing in the population that lived here. I heard a ratio recently that these kinds of jobs that were created during the wartime and Cold War boom also created about 2.5 other jobs, 2.5 other jobs for each job created, say, at Mare Island making submarines or at Hunter's Point, because you had to hire school teachers, you had to hire police, you had shopkeepers. I'm not sure if the current boom of the Silicon Valley would have the same ratio that you had then.
Well, also on the note of education, just for a moment, I was reading where a lot of the philanthropy in the World War II, post-World War II or Cold War boom had a great deal to give to the beneficiaries were universities. And now it seems to be much more environmental or other kinds of at least recipients. And I'm looking at a listener's comments here who writes, it seems like the income inequality in this boom has its roots in environmentalism. For the last few decades, cities have tried to attract clean industries instead of polluting ones like manufacturing. The tech boom has created lots of jobs in a non-polluting industry, but unfortunately, almost all of those jobs are white-collar professional jobs. There aren't many clean industries that employ unskilled labor. It's hard to imagine the Bay Area accepting more businesses that employ unskilled labor. There are already many complaints about the refineries in Richmond or pollution from the ports, two of the last areas where a high school graduate can work and afford to raise a family. Interesting point. Thank you for that. Another listener writes, I wonder and worry about the price of housing in San Francisco and elsewhere. I've heard lately about foreign nationals who are non-residents buying up homes at high prices that they leave empty or just as a pied-à-terre. This is not community. These people seem to have lots of money for speculation, I guess. I heard a news story recently about apartments in New York City selling for $27 to $29 million that are bought by wealthy foreigners and left empty and maybe used for vacation occasionally. Heard the same story, by the way. And this listener goes on to say, I feel this sort of thing is a problem, and I wonder if the government should step in. What can be done about this? It's unfair for normal people who make normal wages, getting smaller all the time, and can't afford these crazy prices. Our country is going downhill. I'm not anti-foreigner, but I don't like anyone buying up all the desirable property at astronomical prices, bidding up the price of homes, and helping it become more and more untenable for the rest of us to live in nice areas or own a decent home. These are real issues. This isn't just concern about xenophobia that we're seeing creep in here. And once again, that caller who said, I'm a San Franciscan. We can't get jobs. The millennials are getting the jobs, or the immigrants are getting the jobs. And again, this is a repetition of what we've seen in other booms in different ways. Yeah.
I mean, what you have in California, and it's true, I think, most neighborhoods. It's true in my neighborhood. Most people cannot afford to buy the house they live in right now. The prices have gone up, and if you were to buy it in the market, you could not buy it.
And what about culture? Do we always see, you know, we go back to the gold rush for a moment. We saw so much prostitution and decadence and vice and all of those kinds of elements. I mean, they were rampant. They were pervasive, largely because, as we said before, 90% of those around were of the male gender. I don't want to give my gender necessarily a bad name here, but there was a lot of boozing and a lot of, you know, all that sort of thing. Seemed to rise with booms, too.
Well, I mean, part of it comes in with booms because what you have is a transient population. I mean, very often with booms, people are not intending to stay here. They're intending to make money. They're not bound by family or community. They're pretty much on their own. And there are the industries that rise up to entertain them. Those tend to be vice industries. And San Francisco in particular, throughout its history, has had a reputation as a pretty wide open town. So San Francisco structurally has been a place which would entertain many industries like this.
I think that's a good point. I mean, San Francisco doesn't have any gold itself. But so why did San Francisco boom during this period? Well, certainly there was the aspect of shipping, but a lot of this had to do with entertaining all these tens of thousands of people who came out here.
Well, and I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in San Francisco for that part of the population we're talking about now, which are the people who ride the infamous Google buses down the peninsula, particularly people who are young and single, because San Francisco right now does not have a reputation as a good place to raise a family. And I think that something is going to give here. Either those people, when they do start having families, are going to move out of the city, or the city is going to have to come up with a way to become more hospitable to those people.
I've got James on from Guerneville. James, go ahead, please.
Yeah, speaking of culture, you know, the discovery of gold, of course, attracted people. But by the time my generation, the boomer generation, came on board, we were looking at other things. We were looking at philosophy. We were looking at all the cultural effects. And people like Bill Graham, who was so instrumental in starting the music scene here in the Bay Area, I put out a clarion call all over the world, including to my very own wife, who came out here from Indiana, and many of my friends who were Midwestern or came from the East Coast came out here and basically took off their inhibitions and partied for a long time, but then settled down and started jobs, and many of these people went into tech. So I'd be interested to hear your comments on that.
Well, I think, you know, if you're going to San Francisco, wear a flower in your hair. I mean, there were a lot of people who were drawn by the music, the culture, and some of that was really a kind of neo-bohemian culture. It was very tied to the arts more than it was to the boom. Almost existed codependent with the boom. Yeah, Leslie.
A lot of companies, Apple most famously, were actively pursuing some sort of a countercultural ideal in building, in that case, computers for the rest of us. And a lot of the language that you heard about what it was like here versus on the East Coast is this interesting blend of sort of laid back, people do what they want.
Forgive me, Steve Jobs wore sandals and didn't have a limo. That's, you know, what immediately comes to my mind.
The guy spent time on an ashram in India. I think there's a legitimate claim to be made there. But even if we want to argue about Jobs, I think that there's a deep, if you look at the roots of particularly the personal computer industry, there's a great book on this by a guy named Fred Turner about the counterculture to cyberculture. Those roots are real. And the language that you heard was this interesting blend of that kind of hippie laid back with precisely this sort of mythologizing of the West that we've been talking about, this notion of new frontiers, of pioneers, of a place where there are no rules, of open pastures, green fields, do what you want. So both of these ideas really started kind of converging when the boom of the semiconductor industry in the 60s.
Well, I think we may have hit a nerve here. I'm just looking at a listener comment online that says, with regards to the more things change, the more they stay the same. This time is different. San Francisco natives like myself and long-term residents are not being displaced so much by a cultural shift but by an economic shift thanks to real estate speculation and pressure on the housing brought by tech workers who are incentivized to live in San Francisco while they work in the suburbs.
Well, yeah. Consider, for example, when we talk about the counterculture and we talk about people wanting to come to San Francisco in the 60s and 70s, large numbers of people from around the country, gay and lesbian people seeing San Francisco as a hospitable place to come. Well, this was a very fortunate, opportune moment because San Francisco was in a demographic decline after 1950. And it was actually, may not have seemed affordable in the 70s, but it certainly was compared to today. So you really couldn't have a new bohemia today necessarily because the rudiments that have to be in place economically to have a bohemia, you have to have cheap housing. And it would be really impossible for someone to come out and recreate the summer of love in 2015.
Yeah. And I'd reinforce that essentially – there's a boom in California in the 60s and 70s. There's not a boom in San Francisco. And that what you get is cultural creativity comes about in San Francisco during its bust, not during its boom.
We're losing 150,000 people in San Francisco when this is happening. And it's interesting, though. I wonder if
there was even a diaspora of artists going to Los Angeles and San Franciscans were pulling their hair.
I wonder if there's any glass half full aspect of this, though, because consider – I know, Michael, I don't mean to slag off – you're from the Buckeye State. And if you consider situation in Toledo, Cleveland, even north of you in Detroit, you have a situation where San Francisco looks enviable compared to what happened in those cities. They weren't able to make that transition.
Well, I want to thank all of you for this most illuminating hour. Richard White, again, is professor of American history at Stanford. His book is Railroaded, The Transcontinental and the Making of Modern America. Christopher O'Sullivan teaches California history at USF. And Leslie Berlin is project historian at Silicon Valley. Her book is The Man Behind the Microchip, Robert Noyce and the Invention of Silicon Valley. We thank you for being a part of this program. Wouldn't be here without you. And you can read more on the history of California's booms and busts and all the stories from our Boomtown series at kqed.org/boomtown. Thank you for being a part of the program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.